Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Institute for Policy Innovation podcast. We're coming to you today from the studios of Salem Media Group in Dallas, Texas. I'm Tom Giovanetti, the president of the Institute for Policy Innovation. Today's October 12th, 2023, and I'm joined in studio, as usual, by IPI's resident scholar, Dr. Merrill Matthews. And today, Dr. Matthews, we're going to talk about whether or not big tech needs more regulation. Now, we've chosen this topic for today's podcast not only because it's a major issue that we at IPI have been doing a lot of work on the last several years, but also because coming up Friday, October 20th, mm-hmm. we're going to be doing our last major distinguished lecture series luncheon of the year here in Dallas on this topic of does big tech need more regulation? Three perspectives, because there are different perspectives on this topic.
You know, it's interesting because many times what we're talking about, there is sort of a right-left perspective on it. Mm-hmm. But in this case, there really isn't. You have people on the right and left who say we need to have more regulation of big tech. And you have people on the right and left and in the center who say we don't need any more regulation on that.
Yeah, it's sort of the old, I know we've talked about this before, but it's sort of the old horseshoe theory that both extremes end up meeting in the middle, mm-hmm. you know? So you have the progressive left wanting big government regulation, and then you have a lot of the grassroots sort of populist conservatives who want regulation as well. And it's interesting because there's two approaches to regulation, right? The progressive left view is you can't trust business. You can't trust corporations. If you give them a free hand, they will screw their customers. And so you got to have government regulation. Anytime something new comes up, you've got to come up with a regulatory framework.
And it's not just businesses and corporations. We're talking about big companies, some of the biggest in the world.
Absolutely.
And so, yes, to this extent, the left tends to want to regulate business. When it comes to big business, large corporations, they want to double down on those regulations.
Not just because they're corporations, but because they're big.
Right.
So that's sort of the progressive view of regulation. The traditional free market view of regulation has been that government should have a light regulatory touch unless there has been evidence of consumer harm mm-hmm. or worker harm or whatever, right? So, you know, we certainly don't have any problem with most of the like health and safety regulation. Where we tend to have a lot of problems is with economic regulation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've talked about there's like two perspectives on regulation, but there's two types of regulation. And one category is health and safety, and one is economic. And when we're talking about regulating the technology industry, we're not talking about health and safety.
Right.
This is purely economic. And it's driven by a number of factors. As you pointed out, on the progressive left, there's just a distrust of big, and there's a distrust of corporations. Mm-hmm. And really, ever since the internet, this is going to sound stupid, but really, ever since the internet became a thing, you know, the left has had a huge problem with the fact that the majority of, quote unquote, the internet is privately owned and privately controlled. Because, I mean, when we talk about the internet is basically a network of networks, right? And most of them tend to be privately owned, whether they're cell phone networks, cable networks, you know, telecom networks. Some of them, you know, you have university networks. We have some government-owned networks and things like that. But for the most part, the internet is privately owned and privately controlled. And from a free market standpoint, we've always seen this as sort of a testament to the idea of free people acting in their mutual best, self-organizing and acting in mutual best interest, right? Because essentially what all these networks have done, like from day one, is just agree to exchange traffic, mm-hmm. you know? So you literally have Comcast network and AT&T's network, and they agreed to just exchange traffic with each other, you know? They didn't set up toll booths. I mean, Comcast didn't say, well, AT&T, if you want access to our network, we're going to have to charge you. So the internet in general is a testament to this idea of just free people and free organizations just self-organizing for mutual benefit.
Now, you mentioned that the left generally tends to be anti-big, anti-corporation and anti-big corporation, anti-big.
Yeah.
ironically, the right historically has not been really anti-big or corporation.
That's right.
They've largely embraced those types of things. If you were a company that went out and created and you grew and you became GE or Caterpillar or something of that nature, became Apple, God bless you, more power to you.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we talk about the right these days, there's really two rights now, right? There's sort of the old traditional, again, free market conservative approach, which is the one that you and I take and the one that IPI takes, and that is that there are benefits that come to consumers from companies gaining scale, right? Mm-hmm. So part of why Amazon can deliver something to you, in some cases, just hours after you order it, sitting on your couch, and you don't have to do it, you barely have to lift a finger. Part of why they're able to do that is that they achieved scale, mm-hmm. right? There are a lot of, you know, a donut shop does not need scale. So you've got lots and lots of donut shops all over town. But there are certain technologies in certain industries where you really can't serve consumers unless you achieve scale. And so that's been the traditional sort of free market attitude toward this is it's not the government's job to determine how many competitors there should be. We let the market work that out, you know, whether there should be lots and lots of competitors or just a few, we let government work that out. What has changed, as you point out, is that now on the right, you now have sort of the populist right, and they are adopting a lot of the attitudes and talking points of the progressive left.
Yes.
They don't like big. Some of it comes from the belief that these big tech companies basically all reflect the politics and the philosophy of the West Coast or the left coast, right?
Which is not unfounded.
It is not unfounded. So whether it is on social media, the content moderation policies, or whether like there are books Amazon has just decided we don't want to promote this book or we don't want to allow advertising for this controversial book or whatever. There's that perception that these big tech companies sort of have a left-leaning approach. Mm-hmm. And so what happens then is that if you don't like that or if you resent that, you want to get back at them, right? And so what we find a lot of times is a lot of folks on sort of the populist right, they just want to take their pound of flesh from big tech, and they mm-hmm. almost don't care how they do it. So, for instance, you've got people at both the federal level and the state level on the right who are like pursuing like antitrust
right.
solutions, right? And
which typically has been more of a leftist thing.
It absolutely has. But then the question becomes, does antitrust solve your problem? You know what I mean? I mean, does making Facebook sell Instagram, you know, does barring Google from merging or buying another company, does that address your complaint? And the answer almost always is no.
And, you know, because we've been talking about the left versus the right, even though they both are sort of going after big tech, mm-hmm. ironically, for different reasons.
Yes.
Because the right, as you're sort of hinting at, feels like big tech has been censoring them and not getting their message out.
Yeah.
Whereas the left has generally been arguing big tech hasn't been censoring enough.
Yeah.
They're letting it out too much.
Exactly. I mean, I think that the left is still mad at Facebook because they think Facebook helped Donald Trump win the presidency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Russian disinformation and all that kind of stuff. The right is mad at social media, again, because of this perceived bias in content moderation, all that sort of stuff. So there are a couple of baskets here, I think, of frustration. And what's interesting, though, is that the various attempts to regulate have either failed to address the underlying complaint or they just run afoul of just the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So I would put these in like three categories. I would say that the first attempt to regulate big tech was on this area of content moderation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So and we've seen legislation. There was legislation in Florida. There's legislation in Texas. Both of those bills right now are being contested in the courts. The Supreme Court recently agreed to hear them. So we are going to get a definitive Supreme Court opinion decision on that. The problem with all of those attempts is that they tend to run afoul of the First Amendment, because if you pass a bill that says that a particular platform, like for instance, has to be neutral regarding speech or has to be viewpoint neutral or whatever, you're running into the problem there of the problem of compelled speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of conservatives should be really careful about advocating that kind of thing, because they didn't like it when Colorado tried to compel speech from the Christian baker Jack Phillips.
Right.
Because he said, this is my cake. I'm a cake designer, and I'm not going to design a cake that has a message on there that I don't approve of. That's essentially content moderation. That's
right.
Jack Phillips exercising his First Amendment right to not have government compel his speech.
And, you know, because you and I both do radio talk shows every now and then, we have callers who call in, and sometimes the producer says, I'm not going to let this caller on
right.
for some reason or the other.
Right.
They're private organizations, both the radio you do and the radio mm-hmm. I do. And so the private organization, makes a decision as to what it's going to let on there. And just because you call in doesn't mean you've got a free speech right to get
right.
on the air and say something.
Exactly. And so if you are a progressive leftist, it may infuriate you that the local talk radio station is conservative, but too bad. You know, you don't have the right to use government to come in and say, you know, I don't like the way this private operator is hosting speech, and so I want to use the power of government to change it. And when you start using just sort of like common sense examples like that, it becomes obvious. I mean, just because you send an op-ed to the New York Times, they're not obligated to run
no.
it.
No. And you don't have a free speech right to appear in the New York Times.
That's exactly right, because it's a private entity. And if the government were to come along and say, New York Times, you have to now be viewpoint neutral. You're not allowed to decide which op-eds you run based on issues or whatever. I mean, that would be just a blatant and ridiculous violation of the First Amendment. So that's the problem that a lot of these bills that are trying to tell private social media platforms how they're allowed to moderate speech, it just runs smack into the First Amendment. And I feel pretty confident in prophesying that the Supreme Court is going to find both of those bills, both the Florida bill and the Texas bill, to be in violation of the First Amendment.
Now, on the flip side, conservatives have said, we're opposed to all this speech regulation from these private companies. So some of them have said, we're going to start a new company out there, True Social and some
right,
others,
right.
that said, we're not going to have those kinds of regulations and so forth on there. We're going to make this an open forum for people to be able to say what they want, and found out pretty quickly
yep.
that that's a problem.
You know, human nature is the problem. And what you find really quick is if there is no filtering or moderating going on, any online platform is going to quickly become dominated by pornography, anti-Semitism, racism, violent threats. I mean, that is what is going to happen. I remember years ago being in Google's offices in D.C. and up on the wall, they had this real-time, you know, display of active Google searches, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was talking to somebody there about it, and I said, that can't be just unfiltered. And, you know, the guy rolled his eyes and said, oh no, there's no way. We could never allow that to be unfiltered, because so many Google searches are essentially for disgusting things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is the problem. Any social media platform, any website, like any journalistic enterprise, like anything, has got to have the right to filter and block and say, we're going to allow this on our platform and we're not going to allow this on our platform. And as you point out, I think when Gab got set up, when True Social
right.
got set up, they make all these promises about, oh, this is going to be unfettered free speech and all that. And you know what? They find out real quick.
I think if I remember right, it was just within a few weeks after Gab got set up that they said, we're actually going to have to step in here and stop a few things, because you can have people planning overthrow of the government. You can have
right.
all kinds of vile
right.
language. It becomes a cesspool.
Well, Apple kicked them off their iTunes store.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, everybody's knee-jerk reaction was, oh, this is not fair. This is Apple trying to pick winners and losers. No, the problem Apple had with Gab was that it violated the terms of service, because it was hosting violent content and it was hosting pornographic content and stuff like that, you know? So, you know, you just people forget about human nature. So anyway, so that's one category of these attempts that runs afoul. The idea of trying to tell these tech companies how to regulate speech runs afoul of the First Amendment. If somehow the government were to say to Amazon, you have to carry this book, You are required to carry that book. That would be just a blatant First Amendment violation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I might, as a consumer, disagree with the decisions that these companies make. I might, as a consumer, disagree with the way Twitter does its content moderation or Facebook. I might disagree. It might frustrate me that Amazon will not allow, you know, Abigail Schreier's book on transgenderism to be promoted on the website. That doesn't mean I get my way, and it doesn't mean I get to use government to sort of enforce my preferences because of the First Amendment. So there's the First Amendment category. The second category is this idea of antitrust, of just coming after them with a great big hammer and just trying to inflict as much damage as possible. The problem with the antitrust arguments is that they don't hold up to normal antitrust scrutiny. So what you literally have to do is change your whole philosophy of antitrust.
Explain antitrust.
Yeah. So antitrust is this idea, and of course, this comes out of the progressive era. This was used to break up Standard Oil and to break up
late 1800s.
Yes, exactly. And you know, in recent history, to break up AT&T. And so the argument is that if a company gains market power and is harming consumers, then the federal government has the right to come in and limit that market power in one way or another, just somehow.
Because the notion is that if once a company takes over and essentially has a monopoly, it will start raising prices and make it very, very expensive is what the argument has
been. Yes. Now, the thing that Robert Bork should be famous for, he's famous for his Supreme Court appointment and the way he was sort of savaged by Democrats. What he should be famous for is his book on antitrust.
Right.
This was his significant legal contribution. And Bork's point was that there is nothing in U.S. law that makes it illegal for a company to have market power. And there's nothing in U.S. law that makes it illegal for a company to have a monopoly. In fact, Bork pointed out that about the only way you can gain a real monopoly in the free economy is with government's collusion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and in fact, it was government who awarded AT&T a monopoly on phone service.
Right.
You know, so Bork's point was this idea of the consumer welfare standard, which is the ultimate goal should be: are consumers being served, and or are they being harmed? And only if there's evidence of consumer harm is there a legitimate antitrust interest, okay? So, you know, this came up with Microsoft, right? So Microsoft, they kept coming out with new versions of the operating system. Every time a version of the operating system came out, it had more features and it was cheaper, right? And so the government goes after Microsoft. And the point is, are consumers being harmed by Microsoft's scale, or are they being helped? And the answer was they were being helped, okay? The people who were mad at Microsoft were not the people who bought Microsoft software. The people who were mad at Microsoft were the companies who had to compete with Microsoft, okay? They're the ones that were upset. So the idea of government taking an active control in managing competition, that's a European approach to antitrust. That's not an American approach. The American approach has always been for decades, has been the consumer welfare standard.
And we should probably mention Amazon in this because Amazon's huge.
That's exactly where I was going, exactly, because it's very difficult to argue that any consumer has been harmed by Amazon. It's a remarkable company, and they have continually made it easier and easier and easier to do things like returns. You know, I mean, if you buy something and you don't like it, you can drop it off at a Whole Foods. You know, you don't even have to put it in a box and mail it back. It is so obvious how much benefit consumers have gotten from Amazon. But the reason that's been possible is because of their scale. But the way they got scale was by serving consumers, right? Mm-hmm. So only an ideologue who just thinks big is bad would have any problem with Amazon. But yet, some do. And in fact, the FTC right now is going after Amazon on antitrust grounds, right? But it's going to take a complete reinterpretation of the way we've approached antitrust for like 40 years in order to make that case. So the people who want to take a pound of flesh out of big tech, they've done it through this attempt to like regulate content moderation. Now they're doing it on antitrust. But the third area, and this is the most recent and most popular, is this idea of protecting children.
Hmm.
Okay. Now, it's pretty clear that there can be some harms to children if they spend too much time on social media or on the internet. But it's also true that there can be harms to children if you let them wander out into traffic, or if you were to let them try to drive a car, or if you were to give them unfettered access to the medicine cabinet. I mean, children are always in danger from one thing or another. It doesn't mean that cars are bad because we're worried about kids wandering out into traffic. It doesn't mean that prescription drugs are bad because you have to protect children from them, right? And so the latest frenzy now on big tech and social media is about, oh, it's harmful to the children, so we have to do something to protect the children. And what you continually find, I think, in the world of regulation is when someone who wants to regulate something fails at the big scale and then fails at the medium scale, what they always end up doing is saying, okay, well, how about just kids? We're just going to try to protect children, right? So you've got bills. You got a bill that passed in Utah, and you've got a bill that passed in Texas that essentially says social media companies must implement technologies that will keep minors from creating accounts and accessing their platforms and their content. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sounds great. You know, sounds like the kind of thing that a responsible parent should be doing, not the government. The problem, of course, here is it's kind of like when you run into the First Amendment problem. Here you run into a real serious privacy problem, because I don't know if you've ever gone to like the website of like a distillery or a liquor company or something, you know, but you go to the website and there'll be this box that will pop up. Are you 21 or older? Yes, you know, yes, no, right? And you just click yes and you're in, okay? There's no real age verification going on. A 9-year-old could click yes, I'm over 21, and they're on the website, okay? So there's no real age verification going on. What the liquor companies do on their websites, that's what's easy to do. It's like an honor system, right? But these bills that are passing now in the states require more than an honor system, because they create legal liability for the social media platforms. So if a 9-year-old goes on a liquor company website, that doesn't create any, in and of itself, that doesn't create any legal liability for the liquor company. Now, if they sold or served liquor to a 9-year-old, they would have legal liability. But just letting them on the website doesn't create any legal liability. These bills that have been written about social media, if a minor accesses the website, that in and of itself creates legal liability. They can now be sued. So the only way you can do real identity you can't really verify age online unless you're willing to verify complete identity. And so what this requires, like, imagine if you were going to set up a Facebook account, and here's what you have to do. Enter your full legal name. Enter your Social Security number. What state, do you have a driver's license in a state? What state is it? Give the driver's license number. Give your full legal address so that we can check property tax records to make sure you're who you say. This is literally how you verify identity online. I've recently gone through this. I had some legal documents I needed to sign, and it was actually really cool, because you can now online in a live real session sign legal documents and actually have like a notary right there online with you verifying who you are, and they can notarize it over the internet without having to be there physically present with you. It's a really cool technology. But the way they verify who you are is what I just described. Okay. That's the only way. If your 11-year-old wants to set up a Facebook account, that is the only way to stop them from doing it, is to acquire that level of privacy violation. Okay. Now, the ironic thing is that the very people right now who are demanding that these social media companies do age verification, they're the very people who are angry and believe that social media companies gather too much of our private information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. but their solution is literally to mandate that the social media companies gather our private information. Mm-hmm. Okay. Literally right now, best practices for privacy online is you're not allowed to gather what's called personally identifiable information. Okay. It's okay if you gather my IP address. It's okay if you can tell what part of the country I'm in. It's okay if you're tracking my purchasing and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. But what you're not allowed to do is gather my personally identifiable information. What these bills now do is mandate that these companies gather personally identifiable information.
Mm.
So it's kind of like, are you sure your solution is not worse than the problem?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know this from your years of working on policy. So many times when people want the government to solve a problem, the solution ends up being way worse than the problem in the first place.
And of course, even if the platform or the company got that information and said, we will not reveal this, we'll keep it, there are hackers who go
exactly,
in
right.
and get that information.
Right. I literally subscribe to an online service that lets me know. It tells me if my email address has been exposed in any major, hacking situation. And I swear, about every 2 weeks, I get a notice.
Hmm.
It's very, very common. I no longer allow websites to store my credit card information. I just don't.
I never did.
It's more convenient to let them do it. But there's so many of these, hacking situations that have come up that it's just not safe to do. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is more than ironic that the people who are mad at big tech because they're tracking us and they have all this information are now wanting to legally mandate that big tech gather that information. Yeah. So these are complicated issues, and it really it calls into question just how serious someone is about their principles. You know what I mean? Do you really believe in limited government, or do you simply want government to do the things you want government to do? You know what I mean? You don't want the left using government to enforce its preferences, but you're quite content for the right to use government to enforce the right's preferences. It calls into question, do we really believe in individual responsibility? Isn't it the responsibility of families and individuals to create a safe environment online for kids? The tools are there. Maybe parents need to get a little more involved. Maybe parents need to say, no, you're not getting a smartphone when you're 9 or when you're 11. I'll give you a crappy little flip phone so you can call home if there's an emergency, but I'm not going to allow you access to Instagram, It's funny to me that this issue sort of exposes, I think, particularly for conservatives, it exposes that they either don't understand some of the principles that they claim to espouse, or they don't actually hold those principles at all. And so part of what's fun, I think, for me in the policy world is, we're not lobbyists. The job of a lobbyist is simply to get a win for their client, and it doesn't really, principles are not involved.
Right.
Right. For us in the think tank world, for us at the Institute for Policy Innovation, it's principles and it's philosophy that matters to us. And we sort of use issues as an excuse to communicate principles and policy position. So that's why I think part of why I think the big tech thing is interesting, because it does expose folks who are like, they don't want the left using the power of government to enforce the left's principles, but then all of a sudden they turn around and they want the government to enforce the right's principles. And, mm-hmm. Not if you believe in limited government. Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. I hope you found it to be of interest. I'd invite you to check out our website at ipi.org and sign up there if you'd like to receive notices of our new podcasts, new content, and upcoming events. If you've enjoyed this podcast, how about giving us a favorable review on iTunes or on your favorite podcast platform? You can also help sponsor these podcasts by becoming a member of IPI's Giving Society. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you next time.